With a piece in my hand and bloodshot eyes, I walk to the water for a last goodbye. He begged so much, it clouded my mind. One thing's clear, the man's gotta die. Man makes right, so he said, when he yelled all the keys over our head. I lived in that grip, but now he'll learn. At the end, with the tables turned, Lord, forgive me, take me on down the river where the guilt can't find a red-handed sinner, on where the grave can't cry out, cause I done wrong down the river with a hand on a Colt and a finger on the trigger, and on before dawn they try to find. By the riverbank, caught a boat staff, took off like a hurricane. With spotlights, dogs, hit the whole nine yards. It's breathing down my neck and breathing hard. 2 weeks in a wild chase across the highways, mountains, over seven states. Found a man at the harbor, said that he could take me across the ocean somewhere far away. Lord, forgive me. Take me on down the river where the kids can't find a red-handed sinner, on where the grave can cry out, cause I done wrong down the river with a hand on a Colt and a finger on the trigger, and jumping off the ledge, but not before it gets due to the chest. Now there's blood and water filling up my lungs. Blood and water filling up my lungs. My heart is beating like a fading drum. Lord, forgive me, here I come. Take me on.
Hi, Hi, this is Val Von Torn of Metatron Power and Light. You're listening to Gary Anderson and Night Dreams Talk Radio.
Greene County, Pennsylvania, was unknown to paranormal enthusiasts until the Kevin Paul Amazon bestseller, Haunted Hills and Hollows, What Lurks in Greene County, Pennsylvania, revealed the phenomena lurking in and the haunted history of the southwestern corner of the Keystone State. Even more high strangeness can be found in Book 2 of the series, Kevin Paul's Haunted Hills and Hollows 2, still lurking in Greene County, Pennsylvania. One thing is certain, it is nearly impossible to be alone in Greene County. These riveting books, Haunted Hills and Hollows, and Haunted Hills and Hollows 2, by author Kevin Paul, in paperback, Kindle, and audiobooks, are available now on Amazon. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio Network, the home of Night Dreams Talk Radio, with Gary Anderson, syndicated worldwide. Paranormal Talk Radio, like you remember.
Well, it's 7:03 here in beautiful Gig Harbor, and I'll tell you what, the 19th of July, time is going by so fast. I tell you, I had that vacation for 2 weeks, and it seemed like it was only a couple days. It seems the older you get, time kind of speeds up, but that's a new topic right there. Well, I hope everybody's been having a great summer so far. The economy. Well, have you noticed when you go to the grocery store, your money doesn't go very far anymore? I tell you, it's weird. Some things are actually haven't increased, but they have decreased in size, I can tell you that. But going to the grocery store, I notice it's getting more expensive. Last month, I spent over $500 more than I did the previous month. And it's going to get worse. And, you know, we are going into hyperinflation. A lot of people don't realize it. They don't even realize we're going into a recession. And the feds, you know, are going to actually put us in a recession to slow the economy down. What's that going to do? It's going to put people, well, out of work. Companies are already starting to put on notices of hiring freezes. And then there's going to be layoffs. So what did this all accomplish when they gave all this money here, you know, last year and the year before? It's really put us in a situation that I don't want to be in. And in fact, people have been saying, well, hey, Gary, you're wrong. Gas prices are going down. Naturally, they're going down because people can't afford to buy gas and fill up all the way now. People aren't going on trips. That's causing the prices to come down. It's not because the economy is getting better. It's because people aren't able to fill up their tank as much. Well, also in the news, can you believe a guy goes and has surgery? They figured he had a blockage. They removed 30 pounds of poop. That's right, poop. Out of his stomach and intestines. And they figured it was building up for 22 years. That is really scary. You know, when John Wayne died, they pulled out quite a bit of, well, weight of meat that was undigested. But you figure 30 pounds of poop and build up for 22 years. Man, that guy was constipated. I can tell you that much. Well, Biden says he's working on a bill to release these people that are locked up in federal prisons for marijuana, which should have never been there in the first place. It's crazy. Well, you know what? We had a strike, a solar flare, but we lucked out. We still are on the internet. My lights work. The ATMs work. But we could have been in the dark ages today, and a lot of people just don't realize it. And I keep telling people, stock up on water, stock up on food, have at least a month of water and food in your house at any given time. Because, you know, we're playing craps here. It's like going to the casino. One of these days, it's going to hit, and it's not going to be in our favor. As Major Ed Dame said on our show before, we could go into the dark ages like that. Well, you know, scientists are trying to supercharge humans by taking, are you ready for this? Bear cells and then injecting them into males. I don't know if I like that one. It's bad enough with pig hearts and everything else, but bear cells being injected into a human body, I don't know about that one. Well, a hunter claims that he had an encounter by a lake for 20 minutes with a Bigfoot. You know, it's been a lot of Bigfoot stories lately, like the guy in British Columbia that has a YouTube channel which really went really bananas after he posted his head and stuff he found in a riverbank of a Bigfoot. Turned out it was false. It was another, you know, ploy to get people to his YouTube channel. But, you know, that's the whole thing. When you get these hoaxers out there doing their thing, it actually does damage to what we're trying to prove. Does Bigfoot exist or not? As anybody who's listened to my show for a period of time, I had an encounter back in the early 2000s with a friend of mine who was a medical doctor. If that wasn't a Bigfoot, then that was somebody's, well, father-in-law that moved out in the woods. And I'll tell you what, it was really hairy and really big. I have no idea. Well, you know, tonight we have a great show. You know, ever since I was a young kid, and, you know, I'm 70 years old, there's been stories going around in the newspapers and on TV about Amelia Earhart, you know, her crashing, and, you know, all these documentaries all through the years, they come up with different ideas what happened to her. Well, tonight we got a great guest who's an investigator who's spent quite a few years investigating what happened to her. He'll be on here in about a minute. Stay tuned. We got a commercial, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to find out what happened to her. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Mind control, satanic rituals, unspeakable sexual perversions. This surreal combination of horror movie shocks and fascist marching orders is the signature of QAnon. Who is Q? In his new book, Operation Mindfuck, QAnon and the Cult of Donald Trump, Robert Guffey draws on his encyclopedic knowledge of conspiracy theories to diagnose QAnon as a highly engineered psyop, calibrated to capture the lockstep loyalty of its audience. Will its followers ever realize they've been had? Go to orbooks.com and order Operation Mindfuck today. Also available on Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Val Von Torn of Metatron Power and Light. You're listening to Gary Anderson and Night Dreams Talk Radio.
For over 20 years, Chris Williamson has been fascinated with the life, legacy, and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. He created the Chasing Earhart Project in 2017 and ran it with the hope of bringing even more worldwide attention to the case and Amelia's legacy. In 2018, Chasing Earhart, the discussion panel, was hosted in Atchison, Kansas, Amelia's hometown. It featured 18 sitting guests in the largest discussion panel ever assembled on the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. In 2019, Chris created and launched the popular podcast Vanished, alongside co-host Jennifer Taylor. In honor of the 85th anniversary of Amelia and Fred Noonan's disappearance and ongoing legacy, Chris is releasing his first book, Rabbit Hole, The Vanishing of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. The book can be ordered by visiting www.intotherabbithole.net.
Well, Chris, welcome to the show, my friend. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, Gary. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I got to ask you a question. What got you on the subject about what happened to her plane? How old were you when you were really interested in what happened?
Well, I was in about third grade when I first saw Amelia for the first time. I was in my classroom. I remember my teacher had all of these 8x10 glossies around the room. We were going to do the standard, typical History Day project that a lot of your listeners have probably done in their lives. And there was everybody who you could possibly imagine up on the wall. And I saw this woman. There's a very famous photo, if you Google her right now, of her with her hands on her hips, and she's got this bomber jacket on. And I saw that photo, and I just was sort of enticed by it. I picked her. Nobody had picked her. And I did my first project on her, and I just kept always coming back to Earhart every year. I would do another project, a book report, a History Day presentation, and as I got a little older, the ideas and the thoughts became a little more complex, and I just never left it. She never left my peripheral, my consciousness. And I just sort of became obsessed with the legacy side of things first, and then sort of the disappearance, which goes hand in hand with her story. It takes place at the very end of her career, of course. She had been flying for 9 years, and I just sort of fell into it. I got sucked in, and I've been doing it ever since. Ironically enough, I sort of left it for a little while professionally, and then we got back into this about 2007-2008, and we started doing pre-research for what would become the start of Chasing Earhart, and from there it's sort of just been going nonstop ever since.
Very interesting. How long did it take you to write that book?
Well, the book is a written transcript of season one of Vanished. It took me about 2.5 years to edit it completely. So it's this really large, mountainous project with almost 50 guests that span across the Earhart legacy and the disappearance and all the lore that you can find out there on her. And yeah, it was about a 2.5 year process from start to finish, from the point we started and then to the point we released the book just a couple of weeks ago on the 2nd of July.
Well, that's why we have you on here. You know, what I found, you know, through the years, back years ago, they made a movie about her life and, you know, her love life and how she crashed and all that stuff. But it didn't even, you know, the movie, you know how movies are. They have to, you know, sell the movie. People want to go pay the ticket to go watch it. And when you really, God, I can't think of the name of the movie, but I'm sure you must have seen it through the years. It didn't really do justice to what she, you know, tried doing and what happened to her.
Yeah, well, there's been a few movies. I think the one you might be referring to is the one with starring Hilary Swank. Diane Keaton also played her years before that. But there was a movie just called Amelia that was out, I believe, in 2009, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, this one goes back at least 20 some years.
Yeah, so that might have been the Diane Keaton version that you saw that was on. There's been several movies that have been out on Amelia Earhart, biographical in nature, and of course there's countless documentaries on her. But yeah, she's a fascinating individual, and she's at the center of what I believe to be the biggest historical mystery ever. There's so many out there, as you are well aware, but this one happens to contain at the center of it really someone who is considered to this day America's sweetheart, and was certainly back then when she disappeared alongside Fred Noonan in 37. So Earhart has been a very interesting topic, and I think will continue to be a topic as long as it's a mystery.
Now, did you research her life when she was a child all the way up? And if you did, what type of childhood did she actually have?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. She was very different from the beginning. She felt like she was sort of this rough and tumble little girl, and she grew up in Atchison, Kansas. She had a really good relationship with her mother and her father. Her mother, Amy Otis Earhart, was a pioneering woman in her own right. She was the first woman to successfully climb Pikes Peak, which is a very large mountain. Her father, who adored her, was a lawyer, but he wasn't really the best lawyer, and he had an alcohol problem, and they sort of clashed a lot when it came to that her father and her mother did, and of course that affected his relationship with Earhart and her sister Muriel at the time. But she was a real rough and tumble kind of girl. She wanted to play sports at the time. She wanted to go explore the bluffs down on the Missouri River in Atchison, Kansas. She wanted to go, you know, she was essentially a spelunker as she was a little kid. She loved to go cave exploring and diving into caves and doing all these really crazy things. And I think Atchison, Kansas, at that time really provided a great foundational ground for her to sort of grow up and become who she became eventually. And she was very different, and I think she knew it at the time. And it just never occurred to her that women couldn't do the things that men could do, boys could do at the time when she was little. And her parents, fortunately for her, really pushed for her and really believed in her. And her grandparents, they clashed a little bit. Her grandmother wanted to, you know, to sip tea and to have parties with her girlfriends and things. And she would kind of, you know, she would oblige for her grandmother, but she didn't really, that wasn't where she wanted to go. And I think it's, if you look at her childhood, even early on, it's pretty evident that this is a young girl who would grow into someone that would change the world. And that's exactly what she did.
It sounds like she was a tomboy when she was young.
I would agree with that. She really was. I think if you look at the sort of the definition of what that is, I think she would fit that pretty nicely. She was into a lot of things that, you know, little boys would be into. She used to shoot, you know, go shoot rats. Her father bought her a rifle when she was young. They played football. They did all kinds of really exciting things in Atchison as kids. She had a really great group of friends around her, and they sort of all liked to do those things, but Earhart sort of stood out from the pack. You know, there's a really wonderful story about her building her own roller coaster in the backyard of her home in Atchison, Kansas, and sort of flying off the roller coaster, this kind of handmade thing that her uncle helped her with. And, you know, she just did things in the very beginning that would sort of indicate the kind of woman that she would become as she got a little older.
Well, a roller coaster in your own backyard. Wow, that is a tomboy if I ever heard. What type of grades did she, what type of schooling did she have?
She was good. She was good in school. She was a little rambunctious, but she was smart. And I think that, again, that reflects as she gets older, because she was attracted to the sciences. She believed in the sciences even as a young kid. I think that's something that really, really spoke to her. And she was a pretty decent student, actually. She wasn't, she acted up a little bit, but no more than, you know, a lot of us do when we're in that age. She was pretty good.
How about, was she into cars?
She was into cars. She had we actually know a gentleman by the name of Jim Summers who owns her 1932 SX Terraplane, and he's completely restored it and charried it out to the exact condition it would have been in when Amelia owned it. She loved to drive fast cars. There's a rumor that one of our guests, who's a historian, met a gentleman whose father actually was a police officer and pulled her over for going, you know, for speeding. And of course, you know, didn't give her a ticket. But, you know, if the ticket would have existed, that would have proved it would have happened. But she was she loved fast cars. She loved fast planes. She was attracted to all of that, even experimental aircraft and things of that nature. She was definitely into speed just in general. She loved it.
What got her into aircraft? I mean, here she was into cars. She was into building a roller coaster in her backyard, going into caves, all this stuff, shooting rats. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like my ex-father-in-law. But, you know, and all this stuff. And then, you know, gets interested in aircraft. I mean, there's a pattern here.
Yeah, sure, definitely. It's almost like a natural evolution, right? I mean, she grew up in the golden age of aviation, so she was privy to wonderful people that were doing amazing things in the air, and that's very inspiring. I would imagine it was probably similar to anybody listening that grew up in the space age and saw people going to the moon and saw people going to the edge of space or out of our atmosphere. I think that would have been really inspiring for her. And I think it's just a matter of what you do with that inspiration. She took that inspiration and sort of dialed it up to 11 and turned it into her career and what she became known for. But yeah, she loved, you know, she loved everything about flight, but it took her a little bit. She really, the first time she saw her first airplane, she wasn't that impressed, you know, and that's sort of another pattern. She meets these characters in her life and she's introduced to flight in her life initially. And you'd think it would be an instant turn on for her, but it wasn't. She wasn't really impressed all that much. But the first time she went up, there was a pilot by the name of Frank Hawks, who was a World War I ace that took her up. And her father paid $10 for that flight and for 10 minutes, basically. And she famously says, as soon as I was off the ground, I knew I had to fly. So it was, I think it was just a matter of experiencing flight firsthand. And I think that that flipped a switch in her brain that just told her that she had to do this. And boy, did she ever. So, yeah, it's pretty remarkable.
Now, that was a biplane, too, that she got her first ride in, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. How about relationship-wise? I mean, did before she got married, did she date a lot much, and that, or did she just go into a marriage, or how did that happen?
Well, she was her relationship status is it's a little murky there. We don't know a whole lot about it. She was previously engaged early in her life to a gentleman by the name of Sam Chapman. They were close for a while, and it just sort of fell apart, as relationships tend to do sometimes, and it didn't work out. But they remained friends, and she just sort of told him that she wasn't essentially ready to be tied down. Maybe she didn't feel like, you know, he was the one. I don't know really what her internal thought process was there. There's not a whole lot of information there. But she, you know, she did date occasionally. I think for the most part, Earhart was very much a loner. There's a very famous quote in a yearbook that we actually determined with the help of one of our guests was not attributed to her, but it's sort of part of the legend. And it's the yearbook quote is "the girl in brown who walks alone." And that's actually not true, but she really did sort of have a loner status as she got a little bit older, got into junior high and high school. She had some friends, but for the most part, she walked her own path, and she traveled around a lot, and she, you know, they were sort of like a traveling band of gypsies, you know, her and her mother and her sister. After her mother divorced her father eventually, they sort of traveled around a lot and tried to set down roots in different states, and Amelia eventually graduated high school, and that's where sort of her career path starts to unfold, but not in aviation. She does a lot of different other things before she goes up in that flight, famously, and decides to pivot to aviation.
Now, was she from a wealthy family? You mentioned her father was a lawyer. Was he one of the lawyers that barely made ends meet, or was he a well-to-do lawyer?
He wasn't a very good lawyer, by all intents and purposes. People that we've talked to said that he was, I guess an average lawyer, if that's a way to describe it. He wasn't that great, but she did come from a fairly wealthy family. They lived in a beautiful house, which is now a museum, their Amelia Earhart Birthplace Museum in Atchison, Kansas. It's right on the water. It's right on the bluffs of the Missouri River. So her grandparents were pretty well off, and she came from a well-to-do family. But as she got older, you know, they struggled a little bit as she got out on her own. And I think it says a lot about Earhart as a person that she didn't truly depend on that wealth to sort of build her own life. You know, she made her own path. And I think there's a really good lesson to be learned there.
Very interesting. So she went on this, well, with this pilot from World War One. It gave her a ride in an old biplane. She kind of got infatuated with it. Then what happened from that point on?
Well, Earhart graduates high school, and she's ironically travels around, and she does lots of different, you know, things to support her obsession. She sort of becomes obsessed with flying. She buys her first airplane on time, and she learns, you know, all along the way, and she learns from a woman by the name of Nita Snook, who sort of becomes this figure, one of the first figures that's in the book that we talk about. It's one of the first figures in Earhart lore. She gets older and gets into aviation. Nita Snook was an amazing aviator in her own right. And she takes all these odd jobs to support herself and to try to get to the point where she's, you know, she can actually support herself and support her hobby and make that a career. But prior to that, she's, you know, she goes up to Canada. She has a stint as a nurse in World War One. She is taking care of some of the people that are coming back from the war, and she sees war firsthand for the first time and sort of becomes vastly opposed to war at that point. She had really a distaste for it. But she travels around, becomes a social worker for a time in Boston, and I think would have probably stayed there had she not been called into George Palmer Putnam's office prior to the Friendship flight, and that's when sort of her career shifts. So she's like the struggling, working, grinding pilot at the time, and she was sort of speaking up, and her voice was beginning to be a little bit louder within aviation, and she was talking a lot about you know, females in aviation and women in aviation. Of course, at that time was a brand new thing, hadn't really been going on for a whole lot. But she goes into George Palmer Putnam's office, and everything changes for her. She accepts this Friendship flight, and she goes across the Atlantic the first time.
Okay,
and
Chris,
that just changes everything.
Okay, we need to hold that, and we'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio.
You're listening to my husband, Gary Anderson, on Night Dreams Talk Radio.
The Mount Blanco Fossil Museum. What a place. It has over 100 fossil trackways, mammoth skeletons, mastodon with living bacteria, 12-toed horse, giant donkey, crocodiles 40 feet long, salamander 12 feet long, wagon trains in limestone, the world's largest bison, blue fossils, black, white, red, purple, brown, yellow, gray, and clear, dinosaur soft tissue, Bigfoot, Mothman, Dogman, Chupacabra, elongated Peruvian skulls, UFOs, giant men, all here at the Mount Blanco Fossil Museum. 124 West Main Street, Crosbyton, Texas, 79322. Open 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. Online at www.mountblanco.com. Call 806-675-7777 or email us at mountblanco1@aol.com. Night Dreams Talk Radio After Dark wants to give a big shout out to all the truckers that listen to our show. Do you remember how great paranormal talk radio was in the 80s and 90s? Night Dreams Talk Radio brings back to you talk radio like you remember, with your host, Gary Anderson, broadcasting to you live from his secret compound deep in the great Northwest. Now, here's Gary.
And here I am, and it's so secret. I took my motorcycle out the other day. It took me 4 hours to find out where the compound was because I forgot where it was at. That's not true. I got on that bike and I didn't want to come back. But when I ran out of gas, that's when I decided to get back and work on the studio. Well, anyway, we have Chris. We're talking about Amelia Earhart. What really was her life like? What really happened to her? There's so many stories out there on the internet, so many movies, and people, you know, really have different ideas what happened to her. Now, Chris, you were mentioning, you know, her romances and all this stuff. I don't want to down, you know, make her sound bad or anything, but I also, you know, on the internet, they said that she was also attracted to the same sex, too. Can you clarify that at all?
As far as I'm aware, that is not the case. There's a lot of rumor and innuendo, as I'm sure you know, your listeners are familiar with, not only with this case, but you know, everything that's covered out there. But as far as I'm aware, and as far as we've been able to uncover, there's not much truth to that. The idea that she was with George Palmer Putnam, who was her husband and who she was with until she disappeared, and then she had the one relationship with Sam Chapman that sort of is part of her life early on. But there's never been anything that I've seen anywhere that proves that beyond just sort of gossip and rumor and people assuming that maybe she was you know, attracted to women at the same time or had relationships with women, but nothing we've ever been able to uncover.
That's interesting. Now, you know, you said she bought her first plane on time payments, just like people do with cars. Yeah. What type of plane and aircraft did she buy?
It was a Kenner Air that she, well, it was a Kenner that she bought, and she nicknamed it the Canary. It was sort of like her first little aircraft that she bought, and it was a really basic little plane. And she did a lot of flying in that, and she also crashed in that a couple times. It was one of those airplanes that she sort of learned and sort of cut her teeth on, so to speak. And it was one of her. It's what we call a deep cut. A lot of people know her little red bus, her Lockheed Vega that she had. Of course, she became really intertwined with Lockheed as she got deeper into her career. But this one was her little Canary that she used and flew all over the place and really sort of cut her teeth on as far as her experience is concerned.
Okay. You know, again, a lot of people don't realize a lot of those old planes, biplanes and the ones that after the war it came out, were a lot safer because when they did crash, a lot of the people were able to walk away from the crash. You mentioned she had several crashes. Did she ever get hurt bad at all in any of them?
Not really, surprisingly, but she wouldn't have been the only one. There was a lot of people that, you know, it was a very dangerous time. Nick, make no mistake about it, but you're absolutely right, Gary. They're very safe planes, and even experts on our very own show and in the book talk about being hesitant to say that they were unsafe because so many people did survive in those planes. But there was a lot of death, of course, as a lot of experimenting going on in the early days, the golden age of aviation. She walked away from 11 crashes in her career, and I think that's really remarkable when you think about it. She was with Nita Snook, who I mentioned earlier, who was with her when she crashed her first airplane in a field that's actually, it's now LAX in that area, and it's a really interesting, fun story. Her and Nita Snook go down in this aircraft. Neither one of them were hurt. Earhart was able to sort of put it down in a way that it didn't cause any fatalities or anything. And this was a crash that was noticed, and people came running over to see, you know, if they were okay. And press happened to be there, and they were running over. And Amelia's turning away from the press and the people that are running. And Nita Snook is telling her, you know, what are you doing? These people are coming to see you. And Amelia's saying, give me a minute. I'm putting on lipstick. So she even then, you know, things like that, she was very self-aware. She knew how to walk a very fine line when it came to a very public persona that maybe didn't necessarily match her private persona. And she just knew how to turn it on like a switch early on before she became really famous. And, of course, when she became famous after the Friendship flight, that sort of changed everything for her. So she maintained that attitude and that spirit all the way through her career and really just knew how to work that angle.
Now, you said 11 crashes that she walked away from. I mean, were the planes totaled in those 11 crashes, or were any of them salvaged, or...?
Yeah, some of them were salvaged. Some of them were shorter crash. You know, they weren't as high up as others. Some of them were obviously higher. But yeah, she totaled some planes. There were some planes that were salvaged and brought back to life and had a second go, and probably were flown by other pilots or even Amelia herself. On a second go round on that particular plane. But yeah, that wasn't really uncommon for those types of aircraft. They were built pretty well, and they were built to withstand crashes to a certain extent. Of course, you know, if you're able to put the plane down, it really took a skilled pilot A lot of people, you know, obviously died at the same time, you know, on other crashes and other aviation accidents at the time. So it was an interesting experimental time for aviation, and Earhart sort of led the way for, of course, for women, but just really sort of became an icon in aviation as she got, you know, deeper and deeper into her career. But at the time, it was very experimental, and a lot of those planes didn't survive, and a few of them did.
How many other women pilots were flying at her, you know, at the same time she was? Was it very rare to see a woman flying?
Well, yes, she was the 16th woman to be licensed. So not, you know, pretty early in the run, but certainly not not the first one. And it escapes me who the first female pilot was. But it's been a long few weeks. But yeah, she was early in the run. She was only, like I said, the 16th pilot and licensed pilot. And yeah, it was fairly rare. You know, men had dominated aviation at that time. And a lot of people would argue that, you know, we haven't made a whole lot of leeway. We talk a lot about that in the book and early on in the book before we get to the disappearance and all that. But yeah, she was early. She was an early pilot. And as far as being officially licensed and officially, you know, allowed to go and to do all these events and stuff, she was one of the early ones.
What was the qualifications back when she first started flying to get a license?
You had to have a certain amount of hours behind, you know, in a plane. You had to be signed off by a certified flight instructor, you know, and that was, of course, Nita Snook and a lot of others that were around at the time. Nita herself wrote a book called I Taught Amelia to Fly. And yeah, you had to have certain qualifications. You had to be able to perform, you know, successful landings, successful takeoffs. You had to be able to sort of dead stick it. You had to be able to pull it. A lot of what really is still in play today. Of course, technology is, you know, 1,000 times more advanced than it was then. I mean, keep in mind, these women didn't have GPS. They didn't have, you know, any of the modern technology. They were literally at times being guided by lit bonfires, you know, to be able to see where they were going. They were out in the elements. They were exposed to weather, to all the stuff that we sort of take for granted now, you know, when we just get on a plane and fly, or get in a plane if we're flying our own plane. So yeah, there were a lot of, you know, strict requirements and that they had to meet. And of course, she met them, along with several other ones that were remarkable pilots as well in the golden age of aviation.
Well, you know, back to, you know, pilots and stuff back then, how they got across country or from one area to another is they followed roads, because, again, there was no beacons, there was no GPS, no nothing. So, yeah. I mean, you know, I guess late in the 30s and stuff, they did have where they could lock into like a radio beacon or a radio signal and lock into that and give them a general area.
Yeah, and that comes into play. That's a great you know, great comment, because that comes into play later during the world flight when she disappears near Howland. You know, the radio comes into play a lot, and we talk almost ad nauseum in the show and in the book about, you know, radio signals and how they were used to, as you said, lock on and allow people that were pulling those radio signals to get a steady signal from the incoming flight, so they could actually land correctly and do the things that they needed to do. So, yeah, it was a very experimental, is probably really the best word, experimental time. And they certainly, you know, they certainly did some amazing things in the air.
Yeah, could you imagine going across country and you're going to land in Seattle back in that time and you end up in Tacoma? I mean, you know, the miscalculation is, you know, not that much back then, because, I mean, again, they followed roads, they followed landmarks and all that stuff. I mean, I was, you know, reading, and I saw a documentary, you know, when they first were delivering mail by aircraft, those pilots, what they had to go through. I mean, you know, it was crazy what they had to go through.
Yeah, absolutely. They did a lot of, they grinded. These are pilots that really believed in what they were doing. They really wanted to be in the air. You know, they, especially these women who did these wonderful things in the air and broke ground and broke through, really just alongside Amelia, sort of helped break the glass ceiling. But then when Amelia came on to the scene, she sort of, you know, I look at it like they were tapping on that glass ceiling and really kind of going at it. And then she just came through and shattered it. And it really gave women sort of a name and a platform and a face, really a face for women in aviation. I think if you talk to anybody, and this is, you know, in my opinion, not a good thing. If you say, tell me, give me a name of a female aviator, everybody's going to say Amelia Earhart. Most people will say that right off the bat. They won't talk about other women at the time, like, you know, Ruth Elder, Ruth Nichols, Florence Klingensmith, Bessie Coleman, Poncho Barnes, all these really incredible women that were alongside of Amelia. But Amelia recognized that she was, you know, getting a little bit of fame, getting a little bit of notoriety, and she ended up using that to, instead of just benefiting herself, she lifted the entirety of women in aviation. And I think that gesture and what she did back then is really resonating still to this day, all the way through aerospace and STEM and everything else that she touched in her career. So,
yeah. How about women pilots at that time? I mean, there wasn't that many. You mentioned like 16 licensed one when she got her license. I mean, yeah. How did were they hostile with you know, each other because each other was trying to prove something?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we talk about it in the book, the formation of the 99s, right? Which is it's still in existence today, and Amelia Earhart was elected their first president. A lot of those early aviators that I mentioned, along with you know, several others, formed the 99s and became you know, became this group of people. They weren't really hostile towards each other, but I think when George Putnam came into the picture with Earhart and started to you know, really push for Earhart, they had some of the other female pilots had some issues with that because they you know, just didn't like the way Putnam sort of handled it. But as far as Earhart is concerned specifically, nobody really ever had a problem with Earhart. They all sort of respected each other. And I think they all understood that they were in the same, I guess, in the same boat, the same plane, so to speak, at the time, and trying to gain traction. And I think they all recognized, had the foresight to recognize that she had the best shot at sort of helping to elevate them all.
Well, here's a heavy hitter question. You know, men are kind of, you know, like for a while, men did not like women truckers. I'm talking male truckers versus women truckers. You know, going back in the 70s and 80s, they really cringed when a woman was driving a rig. How was it with the men pilots, you know, and here's Amelia flying. I mean, what type of response did she get with the male counterparts?
You know, there was some pushback there, certainly. You know, women sort of initially weren't wanted in aviation. They were, I don't want to say necessarily looked down on, but they, you know, people sort of referred to them as, referred to, like, the, for instance, the 1929 Air Derby, where all these women flew in the, what's called the, you know, the Powder Puff Derby now. It's in pop culture, they call it that. They thought it was sort of this traveling circus, and Earhart, instead of caving, Earhart took that as a challenge and said, you know, there's a very famous quote, and I'm paraphrasing, but she said, you know, the men want us to crack up all over the countryside and basically crash out, and the best thing that we can do is prove that those thoughts and those fears are foolish. You know, she wanted to sort of drive it home that women could fly, that they could do anything that a man could do, and that they could represent aviation to the general public. And Earhart sort of changed the game. Well, she did change the game, because you had Lindbergh, who was very famous at the time. And ironically enough, George Putnam, her future husband, published Lindbergh's book 5 years before the transatlantic flight in 1928. And, you know, after Lindbergh had become so famous. And, you know, there was definitely pushback. But Earhart, instead of caving, she pushed forward, and she pushed back against that initial blowback that they got, and I think sort of commanded respect, and it changed everything. I mean, it changed everything for them.
Again, reading on the internet, there was a lot of people at that time frame didn't think she was really a good qualified pilot. What was your take?
You know, I don't agree with that. You know, this is, like I said, a woman who walked away from 11 crashes. She was maybe, you know, not the best pilot, but not because she wasn't a good pilot, if that makes sense. It's because when she hit that friendship flight, and we'll get into that in a little more detail, but when she hit that friendship flight and became really famous and was really just a passenger, she immediately recognized that she was in a very privileged position. And because of that, you know, sort of was thrust into the spotlight. And some people sort of say that that reflects on some of the theory and things later as we get into that. But she, I think, was a very fine pilot. I think she, you know, she pulled off some really amazing feats, altitude records, speed records. I mean, she broke so many different records. And I don't think you can do that if you're not a good pilot. You don't achieve everything that she achieved by accident. You just don't. Not in that time frame, not with those risks, not with that stress. And then I think the reason why she might not have been the best or most skilled pilot was simply because she couldn't, once she became really famous, she couldn't put as much time into just flying purely for the fun of it, as she said. She had to all of a sudden do all of these other things, and she had to sort of shoulder the, I don't want to necessarily say the burden, but it might have been a burden for her at the time to sort of lift everybody else up around her and sort of become the face for women in aviation and really one of the icons of general aviation at that time. So I think if she wasn't a good pilot, it wasn't because she wasn't skilled. It just because she wasn't, she didn't have as much time to dedicate as she probably would have liked.
But 11 crashes. You know, I used to fly a glider. You know, not a hand glider, but a glider. And I belonged to this. At that time, I was with the Civil Air Patrol. And then I had my glider thing all the way up to after I got married. And I only crashed once. And I really didn't crash. But there's a place up near Seattle called Issaquah. And there was an old Kentucky Fried, restaurant near the airfield. And I remodeled it. I took out that steeple. They used to have a steeple on those. And I stayed out too long, and when I came back to land, I was down too low, and their steeple was gone. But I only had one crash in probably 20 years. One crash.
That's remarkable.
I've only had one crash in 40-some years riding a motorcycle. So maybe I knock on wood here, but 11 crashes in that short a span, that's kind of scary. Now, I know that there's a lot of, you know, the engines would fail, the mechanics of that stuff wasn't, you know, all perfected when she started flying, but I mean, that's still 11 crashes.
It's a lot. It's a big number. It's a big number for that time, too, you know, that time in aviation. It's a very large number for her to walk away from. And, it's a testament to fear, really. It's a testament to conquering fear. This is a woman that did not fear anything. And I think, again, we can sort of talk a little bit about her, what many people believe are her final moments, just over Howland Island in that vicinity, and sort of remember that comment I just made about her not having fear, and sort of when we get to some testimony later on about, you know, somebody who was there, who was the closest eyewitness to that event that we can get, talks about it a little bit, experiencing her firsthand and kind of what she sounded like and all that. But yeah, she was, for the most part, a woman who conquered fear. She looked at it and she just kept grinding on it until she wasn't scared of it anymore. And I think that's a testament to, I think that's why she speaks to so many children now that still write letters, you know, to that birthplace museum, her house in Atchison, Kansas. They get them still to this day. People look to her as sort of a beacon of hope and a beacon of standing up against fear and sort of looking it in the eye and just saying, I'm going to do it anyway. And I think it really adds to her legacy and to her spirit.
Well, actually, she was a beacon from the standpoint she was one of the first women to get a license, you know, and fly, and that was unheard of. I mean, let's face it, at that time frame, women were, you know, they weren't women truckers out that time. They weren't, you know, people, you know, they did, you know, women type jobs back in that time frame. And then to have somebody who wanted to fly and was competitive in it, I think that just raised eyebrows.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, to her credit, I think she recognized that. And I think when she met Putnam, I think that to his credit, he recognized that, you know, he recognized that she recognized it, basically, and they decided to capitalize on it together. And really, you know, they've got something special here. And I think, if they hadn't made that decision, maybe we're not having this conversation, because maybe without Putnam, you know, maybe without them two being together and the promotion that he provided and the platform he provided, you might not be talking about Earhart in the same manner that we are today. So, you know, it's really interesting to see how everything sort of weaved into her life and the little choices that she made that became, in retrospect, groundbreaking choices. And, you know, that's why everybody is sort of so obsessed with her disappearance, that because she's this really majestic figure at the center of it. It's not like D.B. Cooper or Jack the Ripper or John Wilkes Booth or some of the other people that we've covered on the show. This is really inherently good soul, you know, at the center of this whole thing. And that's kind of, again, adds to the tragedy, I think, of this whole disappearance and this whole mystery over 85 years now.
Okay, she met her fiance, got married. And what type of person background was he? Was he well-to-do? I mean, to be able to support her flying and all this stuff, I mean, did he have the means, financial means behind him?
Yeah, he was a publisher. He had worked with, as I said, he had worked with Charles Lindbergh before. He had his own publishing house, the publisher, the Putnam Publishing Company. And he was, I think, well off enough to where he has sort of made a name for himself and established himself. And he just, like I said, he just knew when he saw her, there's something about her that he thought, okay, this is my Lady Lindy. That's what he sort of, you know, they named her. They had Lucky Lindy and then they had Lady Lindy. I think he was looking, when they found her, he was certainly looking for somebody to accompany the two male pilots, Stoltz, Wilmer Stoltz and Slim Gordon, across on this really groundbreaking trip, the transatlantic flight in 28. And he had the foresight to look at her and say, okay, she's the one. And he pushed her with everything that he could, and he mortgaged his, you know, basically his fortune on supporting her. So, you know, that's really enough props don't really go to GP, as she called him, because, you know, he was a very smart businessman and he used his money wisely, and he did have a nice background to be able to sort of help her support and lift her up a little bit.
Well, how about this aircraft that she had that she perished in? I mean, what was the make of it? What type of craft was that?
Yeah, it was a Lockheed Electra 10E. It was a special plane. It was outfitted for her world flight, and she had a very good relationship with Lockheed. She had the famous Lockheed Vega. She called it her little red bus. She broke a lot of records in that. She flew across the Atlantic the second time by herself in that plane. And that plane now sits in the Smithsonian right now, and I was lucky enough to stand under it. It's pretty breathtaking. But this Lockheed Electra that she disappeared in, that her and Fred Noonan, I should say, disappeared in, has been the center of an ongoing investigation on multiple facets for 85 years now. And it was nicknamed the Flying Laboratory. It was financed by Purdue University, who Earhart had a very good relationship with for about a year and a half. It was kind of a new relationship, but it was going to be really her future when she returned. And it was a state of the art. It had everything you can imagine on it. And it was actually built twice. It was built first and given to her, gifted to her by Purdue. And she wrecked it in Hawaii.
Wait a minute. She wrecked it? What happened now?
She wrecks it. Yeah, it's the start of the world flight. If you sort of fast forward through to the beginning of the world flight, she had a much larger crew. They took off from Oakland and they got to Hawaii and broke a speed record on the way. And in Hawaii, early morning, she took off to actually make it to go from the second leg of the flight, which would have been Hawaii to Howland, which is actually where she disappeared ultimately. And she ground looped the plane. A ground loop, the best way I can describe it, I'm sure you know, is, you know, if you take like an empty grocery cart and you just push it down the aisle and it sort of turns in on itself, that's kind of what happened. And she wrecked that plane, and that set the world flight back several months. They had to change directions. And that might have been that one error that she made might have been really sort of the beginning of the end for her, and ultimately for Fred Noonan, who stuck around after that ground loop and continued with her on the world flight once they sort of rebooted and recalibrated everything and rebuilt the plane.
So, I mean, where was the plane? Was it flyable to go back to the manufacturer to rebuild it?
Or no, they shipped it back. Yeah, they shipped it back to California, and they worked on it. It took 11 branches of the U.S. government to come together to rebuild that plane for her in the middle of the Great Depression. And a lot of people look at that as maybe a turning point in the world. Well, it was a turning point in the world flight, but a turning point for multiple reasons, really, depending on who you talk to.
Now, we got to talk more about this when we come back from our break. This break is about 4.5 minutes long. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio. We have Chris here. We're talking about Amelia Earhart, what happened to her. And we're trying to find out more about her, which a lot of people, even myself, I didn't even know about it. 11 crashes. One thing before we go on break, was that included in the 11 crashes, or did that take it to 12?
That would have been 12.
Oh, like my wife with her cars. Okay, we'll be back with Chris. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio.
The paranormal and things that go bump in the night. Ghost stories, mythological gods and monsters, even UFOs. How do we square them with sacred scripture? Journey into the unknown with author and journalist Richard D. Lewis and his new book, The Paranormal Christian, Book 2. In this riveting guide, you'll discover a mystical exploration of paranormal phenomena through the lens of the Bible, the gateway between life and death and the afterlife. Stories of departed loved ones communicating from the other side. Real encounters with angels, ghosts, and other extraterrestrial beings. The true story of UFOs and the divine secret to end an alien abduction. If you believe in the Bible, you already have faith in the unseen, the supernatural. The Paranormal Christian Book 2 by Richard D. Lewis. Order your copy today at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or RichardDLewisAuthor.com.
Gonna take you for a ride in my brand new car.
My brand new car.
Gonna take you for a ride in my brand new car.
My brand new car.
Gonna show you how the shifter feels, 'cause tonight is the night that we make it real. Gonna take you for a ride in my brand new car.
Come along on a unique journey of adventure and discovery. Read On the Trail of Bigfoot, a first-hand account from paranormal researcher and skilled outdoorsman Mike Dupler on his many years of investigations into the Bigfoot phenomena and his personal encounters with these enigmatic creatures of the forest, complete with photographs. Don't delay. Order your copy today. This book, will inspire those who have answered the call to seek this elusive creature, the Bigfoot. The truth is out there. On the Trail of Bigfoot by Mike Dupler. Available now at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and IndieBound.org. Now, on Fridays, you can call in and talk to Gary and his guest. Gary will open the call lines at 8 p.m. Pacific Time each Friday. To call into the show south of the Rockies, the number is 1-253-203-6681. That's 1-253-203-6681. East of the Rockies, the number to call in is 1-253-203-6777. That's 1-253-203-6777. Are you into the paranormal? Then you have found the right place. Night Dreams covers the topics you want to hear. And Gary always has a great guest to take you for a real ride in talk radio. So, buckle up and let's go for that ride with Gary.
And we are back, and we're talking about Amelia Earhart. What happened to her? So she had this special plane that was kind of built for her to do this world thing. I mean, what was different about it compared to a normal aircraft at that time?
Well, it had a lot of extra fuel tanks that were in it. They expected, you know, this is roughly a 29,000 mile flight that they were going to be taking equatorially. She wanted to leave no doubt that she was a great pilot, and that when she came back, nobody could really say that she, you know, skirted around or anything or shortcutted anything. So they outfitted it with several fuel tanks that could actually make the plane go a lot farther and can go a lot longer on flight time than a standard Lockheed Electra 10E at the time. She had upgraded engines on it that were a little bit more powerful that could help with the potential headwinds that they could encounter around the world. And she, depending on who you believe, it may or may not have been outfitted with cameras. And Earhart was an avid photographer herself, just a photography fan, as you know, you and I talked about offline. So she, depending on who you talk to, this thing might have had cameras all throughout the belly of it and on the side of it that were sort of hidden little gems so she could take images. Now, of what is sort of up for debate.
Well, at that time, we weren't in World War II, but we were getting close to it. And the Japanese were, you know, doing their thing. And you really think about, again, who read their articles about. The military helped her out, you know, with her aircraft, yeah. Like you mentioned, transporting it, you know, funding certain things. Maybe she went to bed with the government from the standpoint, hey, we'll take care of your aircraft, the expenses, but we want you to fly over this area and get photographs.
Yeah, you hit the nail right on the head with that. As I said earlier, Earhart had a distaste for war, and I think after the ground loop incident, you know, after that devastation, for her personally, financially, professionally on that world stage, remember, the world was watching this flight. This was at the time she disappeared. She was really the most famous, certainly the most famous woman in the world, definitely for sure, maybe the most famous person in the world. And I think if Earhart felt that maybe there's two different options here. If Earhart felt that maybe she could help, she could do something that would help prevent a major world war, that might coax her into doing it. But what you just talked about is exactly what a lot of people believe that are investigating this, and that is that she was maybe strong-armed into doing something that she would never normally agree to, which is participate in a, I don't like to use the word spy mission, but, you know, people, for lack of a better term, a spy mission to maybe help take some images and perform some recon in and around the Marshall Islands or the Japanese mandated islands at the time, in an area that we certainly could have used more intel on. And you figure This is someone who's flying around the world. She's world famous. It's a really great excuse. It's a really great, you know, decoy or reason to get over there and to take those pictures, you know, quietly and discreetly. And yeah, when she ground looped her flight and was sort of, you know, everything was up in the air, her future, they might have strong armed her exactly as you said and said, hey, you know, you it's quid pro quo, you know, type situation. And she might have had no choice, you know, depending on who you talk to.
Well, what's your gut feeling after all this investigation and all the research you've done?
It's really tough. It, for me, it changes by the day. There's this really great analogy as far as, you know, all the theory goes. And of course, we'll get into theory in a minute, but all the different theory, you know, it's every time you look at something in and of itself, you can sort of be bought and sold by that one theory until you see the next thing. I really believe that it's certainly possible that Earhart and maybe even Noonan, we don't know who would have known, or maybe if Noonan would have known and Earhart didn't know, you know, we don't really know. It's murky there. But I believe it's certainly possible and plausible that, you know, at that time frame with being out of money, that she might have, she could have been strong armed into it. We don't know how that plane was rebuilt. We have some parts lists and some things of that nature, but we don't know if there's anything specific on that plane that was added after the fact. There's a lot of rumor and innuendo that goes into this case, and there were people that worked on her aircraft, a gentleman by the name of Art Kennedy, who supposedly installed some of the cameras in her plane, and she was sort of friendly with Art Kennedy, and she, you know, basically told him at one point, this is based off of some theory, but basically told him, hey, you know, offhandedly, hey, Art, can you believe it? I'm going to be a spy. You know, I'm going to help. I'm going to do this. And, you know, who knows if that's really what happened, but I think it's certainly plausible. I think it's certainly, you know, a possibility that she could have been coaxed into this and that she could have been ultimately doing a little bit of recon for the U.S. government. No harm, no foul. We're just going to take some pictures. Maybe they coaxed her into that with the hopes of, you know, as far as she was concerned, preventing a war. And it's very possible. Very possible.
Yeah, and it probably got her killed, too, if you really think about it. There's rumor, too, that her her navigator wasn't the very best navigator out there.
Yeah, I would probably disagree with that even stronger than Earhart not being a good pilot. Fred Noonan was a giant in navigation. He mapped a lot of the oceans for Pan Am. He wrote, when they say, you know, the term, this guy wrote the book on he wrote the book on celestial navigation. This guy was, if you're going to do this, I say this all the time and it bears repeating, if you're going to do a flight of that magnitude at that time, there was no one else on the face of the earth you'd want on that flight with you other than Fred Noonan. Fred Noonan was a fantastic navigator and sharp and, you know, quick with his navigation and just knew what he was doing. And there was rumor that he had an alcohol problem, that he was let go from Pan Am for that, you know, ultimately that he parted ways with them. But I think Noonan, even on his worst day, I think was probably better than 99% of the navigators in the world at the time. And I think anybody who says that he was not a good navigator, or that maybe he was too hungover to navigate correctly, you know, that's possible. I mean, but I think even then he was, you know, you get some coffee in him and things of that nature. We've had a lot of historians talk about that, say that he would have been, you know, sharp as a tack with no problem. So I don't think he was a, I don't think that factors into the world flight. I truly don't. In my heart of hearts, I believe he was on. He had him there. And that sort of, again, just adds to the tragedy of it.
Well, again, depending on what documentary you watch or what you read, they were lost.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
So I wonder what happened, how they got lost. Is there any speculation how they got off course?
Well, sure. There was, you know, they take off from Le New Guinea, which is their last stop. So it basically, they get to Le New Guinea, and they're going to take a trip from Le to Howland Island, which was roughly a 19 to 20 hour flight. They were about 22,000 miles into the world flight out of earlier I said it was 29,000. So they're about 22,000 in at this point. So they're almost there. And the problem with celestial navigation at that time, if you hit unanticipated headwinds, if you're off by just a little bit, then you could be off by hundreds of miles potentially. And so, you know, if he was off even a little bit, it could have really cut them bad. But I really feel like, based off the radio signals, based off of what the Itasca, who we haven't really talked about, what we haven't talked about yet. But based off of what was going on at that time in the final moments, according to the U.S. government anyway, the final moments of her life and of that flight, she was saying, "We must be on you, but cannot see you. You know, we're on the line 157337. They were telling them where they were at. Earhart was basically saying, "We're about 200 miles out, about 100 miles out." So they're, you look at what she was saying, and then you look at what the Itasca, which was a little Coast Guard cutter that was stationed off the coast of Howland Island, where they were supposed to land and refuel, you know, they're taking radio signals. We talked about that earlier a little bit, and they're constantly putting down S5, which is a signal strength 5, which is the strongest signal strength you can get at the time. So they're coming in S1, S2, S3, S4, and S5, and it's just a constant stream of S5s when she goes down. So you add all that together, and it's pretty compelling evidence that maybe a lot of little things just added up to Earhart and Noonan having a very bad day, the worst possible day you can imagine, and that the plane potentially lies beneath 18,000 feet of water, roughly, somewhere in an area the size of Texas. So good luck.
Well, again, depending on where you go and, you know, check, supposedly, you know, a lot of people say it crashed on a reef next to the island. So
yeah, that's an alternate theory. Sure. Castaway, the idea. And it's actually that puts them further from the island. So the way we explain this, or the way I like to explain it when I do, you know, interviews and media and things of that nature, is we look at this based off of a foundational point. So Howland Island is where they're supposed to be. That's ground zero, right? That's where they're supposed to land. That's where they're supposed to refuel. So you start with that. And the idea that she was saying, again, I'm a couple hundred miles out, 100 miles out, that puts her roughly in that area. So you start with that baseline, and theory abounds. As soon as she disappears, theory abounds. So they're trying to figure out where she's at. They put this massive search together, and again, in the middle of the Great Depression, likely ordered by FDR, who was a close personal friend of Earhart. So, you know, she had the connections to put that, you know, for people to go look for her. And the island idea that you're talking about, it's called Castaway, and it puts her roughly 400-ish miles away from that particular spot. And so you have to sort of buy into the idea that they had enough fuel to arrive at Howland, an island called Gardner Island at the time. It's now called Nikumaroro, and put the plane down successfully on a coral atoll there, and have enough gas to send and create what's called what's known as the post-loss radio signals in the disappearance side of the story. So, yeah, that puts her about 400 miles away from her, from where she was intending on going. Again, depending on who you talk to.
Again, too, you know, they talked about, you know, there were some people that supposedly saw a man and a woman, Caucasian, being executed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a thorny one. It's Japanese capture is a really interesting theory. It's another theory. You have crash and sink, which is, again, foundational. That's what people believe, you know, might have likely happened to them. And then you've got castaway, which is an island theory, the idea that she dies as a castaway on an island. And then you have the idea that she was captured by the Japanese. And now this takes her about 800 miles away. So now we're doubling up that 400 miles, and we're taking her to the Marshall Islands in Saipan. And it gets really thorny because she's either shot down, she puts the plane down successfully, or she crashes, depending on what theory you decide to go down. And like I said, it gets really interesting. A lot of alleyways here.
Well, couldn't she too? You know, what I heard, she was running radio, that she was running out of fuel, low on fuel, and maybe being lost. That 800 miles when you're in an aircraft is nothing. I mean, you know, when you're out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, sure. And that's an excellent point. And that sort of ties into the idea that, you know, as I said earlier, if Noonan was off a little bit, you know, even if he was off just more than a little bit, it could have certainly put him in an area that was, you know, into the Marshall Islands or one of these other, you know, spots. And so, but really it comes down to, how much fuel did she actually have left? She says gas is running low, but that's all she says. So if you're driving in your car, Gary, I'll take you as an example. When you're driving in your car, you're on your motorcycle or something, when do you say to yourself, gas is running low, I should refuel? About what point? How much gas do you have left when you say that?
About 10 miles.
Okay, so That's one aspect of it. Some people, quarter tank of gas is running low, I should probably stop and fill up. Or half a tank. People are, yeah, a lot of people that are obsessed with topping off at half a tank. They just like to fill half a tank, especially right now. So, you know, we don't know what she meant. We don't, there's a lot of speculation over what gas is running low meant. And yeah, you're very right. She could have had more than enough fuel to get to some of these destinations, but you know, the S5 signals that were going at the time, the gentleman on the, that I mentioned earlier, who was the closest thing to an eyewitness that we have to the official story, and I'll say official story, which is the crash and sink idea. His name was Leo Bellarts, and he was a radio man on the Itasca. He was the chief radio man there. And he famously says on our very own show and in the book, he says, I came outside, stepped outside the radio room, expecting to see her come out of the clouds or come out of, over the horizon and fly right over the ship. And she never showed up. That's how close the signals and how strong the signals were when she was telling them essentially where she was. So you have to take that into consideration. Do we believe Amelia? Do we believe what she was saying? And to take that into account, or do we believe that, hey, maybe she's in the Marshall Islands when she's saying that, and there's some skip involved or something of that nature that's causing her to register S5 signals.
Well,
to the
that's
Itasca,
something,
you know? We don't know.
Somebody needs to go back and check and see what the sunspot activity was, you know, because they've been, amateurs been tracking that for years.
Sure.
And track and see if there was possible her signal could have been bouncing around. And
sure,
that could have maybe caused it. But again, you know, there's one individual that claims that there was a plane that crashed on a reef, that they survived. And mm-hmm. they were executed right there by the Japanese. Now, maybe they found cameras on the wreckage, and they've, you're a spy. And you have to realize the mindset of the Japanese military back then, they were very cruel to people.
Yeah.
I mean, they tortured people. They did, I mean, executions was like, hey, we don't take prisoners. You're gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another excellent point you make. You know, they don't, you know, they very well, let's go with the idea that she put the plane down somewhere in the Marshall Islands and they got out of the plane and they were immediately captured, right? So they're immediately taken into custody. The Japanese might not have known who they had right out front. It's possible. And then they could have found out shortly after, hey, there's cameras on the plane, there's equipment inside that you shouldn't have, whatever the case is. Or it could have been one of those scenarios where they had them in custody for a while. If you look at the Jaluit dock photo that was the center of that Amelia Earhart, the lost evidence that came out in 2017, that famous, now infamous, I guess, dock photo with, it shows Noonan and Earhart and all that stuff on this dock. If you look at that photo, that goes exactly against the Japanese really knowing maybe who they had. They were hanging out with locals. They didn't seem to be in any distress, but that could have certainly changed on a dime. You know, the river turns on a dime in cases like this. So it's very possible that she could have, they could have determined, okay, you're a spy, and now we're going to change sort of the way we keep you and the conditions we keep you in. And none of those results are pleasant. Some of them are quite horrifying. And not only for Earhart, but for Noonan. And a lot of people that investigate Japanese capture, Marshall Island, Saipan theory, whatever you want to call it, believe that if they are right, if that is exactly what happened to them, then they should be honored by their country, because they were killed years before World War II. And if they were not giving up secrets or not giving up who they really were or their reasoning for being in that area, or the Japanese just didn't buy it or whatever you want to say, you know, if they were executed, they should be honored by their country for that. They should have medals. They should be awarded posthumous military medals for that. I mean, that's a huge deal. It gets into really murky waters, and you know, that's a lot of people that believe that she was captured believe that that's the case. And you know, we just don't know, unfortunately. We don't know.
And I'm just wondering, is this going to be one of the things we'll never know what actually really happened? Because there's a couple of scenarios. I mean, you know, like on that one island where they found parts of a skull, you know, fragments mm-hmm. and stuff that they couldn't get DNA off of it. Like I was telling you before we went on air, maybe in the near future, because DNA testing is really advancing big time. Sure. They can maybe put that at rest, at least. I mean, there's a couple different ways we can go down this rabbit hole. And by the way, I love the name of the book.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's not unlike a lot of other famous, well-known cases, folks you've had on your show, I'm sure, talk about all, you know, what they consider to be their cases, the ones that they study. It's not unlike that. These are all rabbit holes. It's the definition of it. Just when you think you've got the answer, we change the question, or we add 10 more questions, or it opens up a whole other can of worms. There's another gentleman that is another theory. It's an island theory. It's known as the Buka theory, and that actually has an aircraft at the end of it. And that skip and sort of bouncing off the ionosphere and everything sort of plays into the explanation for how they could have been that far away and still registering S5 signals at the Itasca level. They could have been on different frequencies. There is a lot of information going around about this case, a lot of active investigations on this case. And I'm optimistic. You know, I really believe that I don't go to my grave without this being solved. I really think that this gets solved. I think the people investigating it, the methods of use in those investigations, they're some of the brightest people on the face of the earth. And I think if anybody's going to crack it, it's going to be these folks that are investigating these different theories. And I think that's how you do it. You don't try to prove a single theory. We've been trying that for 85 years. It hasn't yielded any results. You have to change the way you investigate these types of cases. And the way you do that, in my opinion, is you don't work on approving a single theory. You work on elimination of other theories as much as you can. And so you whittle it down to what must be the truth, or a version of the truth, or as close as you can get to that truth. And it's very possible that some of these folks could have a piece of the puzzle. This could be a multiple theory type thing where maybe one group has got 40% of it and the other group has got 25% of it, and you put it together and then you've got your ending. And I wouldn't be surprised if that was the end result after all these years. I really wouldn't.
I like to see it in my lifetime. I'm 70, so they got to hurry up. But maybe, you know, maybe the governments, the United States government and the Japanese government, really know what happened. And they're just keeping it quiet, you know, just like a lot of things. But again, maybe they'll find the wreckage, or what's left of the wreckage. They found the Titanic. And people didn't think that ever could happen.
Sure. And those folks that found the Titanic are involved in the Earhart case. You know, Tom Detweiler, who's a giant, who's a great, great guy and a good friend. He was the operations manager on Titanic. So he was with them when they found it. And of course, Bob Ballard, who was the chief on that expedition, recently went with National Geographic and the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. They went out to Nikumaroro, the island we mentioned earlier, and I believe that there's going to be I know for sure there are future deep ocean searches that are being worked out right now, detail wise. So, you know, they're not stopping. Bob Ballard in the trailer for that Nat Geo documentary says something really great, I think. You know, and this is definitely not a knock at any of these things, but it's really sort of eye-opening. He says, look, this isn't the Loch Ness Monster. This isn't Bigfoot. We know this plane existed. We know it. We have video of it. We know all of that stuff, and it's there. It's somewhere. But, you know, we don't know much more than we knew July 3rd of 1937, the day they, you know, after they disappeared. There's everybody who's anybody is thrown their hat into the ring on this, and everybody struck out, and that enhances the rabbit hole. Really, that's what it does. It sucks people in, and people just don't know. And you know, we want to change this from a question mark to a period on the end of the sentence. We want to know Amelia Earhart died XXX. This is how she died. We want to know. And I don't think we're ever going to stop until we know. And I don't care personally who finds out or who gets it right. That's not about getting it right at this point. It's about just resolving this, because she was an icon. Noonan was an icon, and they deserve to have their stories ended, especially if it's controversial, especially if they were killed in Japanese custody or something along the lines of that. That just makes me angrier. Like, that just makes me want to push harder to find out what happened. And I think that's the same motivation that pushes all these people that are investigating this case. We're all human. We all want to know.
Well, it's just part of history. We really want to know what happened to her, for we can put it at rest. And that's what we need to be able to do. Your book, you said it took about 2+ years to write the book. How's it doing?
So far, so good. We've had a real lovely, warm reception so far. We just kicked off our book tour in Atchison, Kansas during the Amelia Earhart Festival. They hold it every year, except for the last couple years. This is our first year back. We returned to Atchison after our panel in 2018. We came back this year with the book and debuted it. And we had a very lovely reception. Atchison does a great job of honoring Earhart's spirit and legacy. And so that was a kickoff. It's done really well so far. We're very pleased with it. I'm honored to have it out. I'm honored. This is my coup de grace. This is my life's work. This is everything I've got on the case. This is not really just me. I'm sort of just narrating this and telling the story through color commentary and through my eyes as I'm experiencing it. The stars of the show are the people in the book. Almost 50 guests across all the legacy and disappearance realms that are helping me tell this story of Earhart and giving everybody a good snapshot of the case as we know it. And as I know it, it's the largest written effort ever put out on Earhart, and about a little over 800 pages. It's a really big, steep, deep read. But I hope people get something out of it. I hope that inspires them to do their own research, and maybe it'll turn somebody on that will end up solving the case ultimately. I mean, that's all we can hope for. But so far, it's been a really lovely experience. It's been really wonderful.
Now, Chris, do you have a website you can share?
I do, yeah. So you can get the book on Amazon, of course, Barnes & Noble, all that jazz. But if you want to get a signed copy or just a copy directly from me, we do put a lot of fun, interesting extras into the presentation when we ship out copies. You can go to intotherabbithole.net. That's the book portal. That's where you can order a signed copy, and we will send that out to you. And that's the primary spot you can get it. And, of course, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all that.
Well, Chris, I really enjoyed having you on the show. You have a great week. And again, maybe, if you get any more information ever, let us know.
Absolutely. I'd be honored to come back on. Thank you so much for having me, Gary. It's been an absolute pleasure and just a true pleasure to be here.
Okay, my friend, you have a great one.
You too.
Okay. Well, tomorrow we got a great show. We're going to talk about ghost hunting. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about haunted objects and all that stuff with Steve Shipley. It's going to be a great show tomorrow. And, we're going to be having topics that we normally don't have on the show now since we're growing. I hope you guys like the music we're playing. I hope you like the longer 2-hour show versus an hour and a half. Don't forget, on Saturdays at 7 p.m. Pacific West Coast time, 10 p.m. Eastern time, I have an hour show called Night Dreams. We're going to get down deep into the paranormal. We're going to get into the scary side and macabre side of the paranormal. Well, till tomorrow when we talk about ghost hunting and haunted objects. Could you imagine you have a haunted car? That would be really scary. Well, till tomorrow, everybody have a good one. We will catch you in the other side of the river.
Of a southern man, daughter of a free man, children of the Civil War. Blackbird on a limb, both of them diving in deeper than they've been before. And down a red dirt path, covering their tracks, strangers in the light of day. Can't fight, I can't stop, and if they get caught, it's gonna be hell to pay. So baby, meet me down by the rolling oak river, where the cool dark water meets the full moonlight. If we can sneak away, maybe we could be together. Can't nobody stop love tonight. Didn't know they'd been followed down through the hollow till the hand grabbed her by the arm.